This is a plot that's relatively up to date, relatively recent, of the constraints on the axion parameters, QCD axion parameter space. So as I said, it's extremely predictive. Basically, you have up to details about the Wilson coefficients coming from different UV completions. There are very few free parameters, and once you pick F axion, you've picked the mass. So you can plot on either axis. And this is a combination of all the sorts of constraints that we currently have. So here is the sort of the stellar cooling constraints that I was discussing just before we finished. For horizontal branch stars, white dwarfs, red giants, and this is for supernova 1987A. And you can see that the constraints on FA go all the way up to about, you know, in these units, up to about 10 to the 8 GeV or so. The QCD axion can also give you a very successful dark matter candidate. It could be the dark matter. And the dark matter is really like, you can think of it as a condensate of the QCD axion, so that the axion is a very, very light particle. You can see these masses are very low. But in the early universe, the axion, as I said, will not be at the bottom of its scalar potential. And actually, it's only until after the Hubble constant has gone below the QCD scale that the QCD axion will start to roll about in its scalar potential, and it will start to oscillate. And those oscillations essentially behave like cold dark matter. It's an oscillation of a condensate, but it behaves like cold dark matter. And the regions of parameter space that give you good dark matter candidate through this mechanism are around here. So these all depend on where the axion was initially sitting in its scalar potential. But you can get a good dark matter candidate from it around here. And you can also look for it not just using stars, but experiments. So for example, in this mass range here, it could be produced in the sun via scattering. And then it could scatter in a detector, essentially convert into a photon in a detector, giving you an X-ray photon. And these are experiments that search for dark matter axions, giving two different manners. So this one looks for dark matter axions that are oscillating, because we're in this condensate and it's oscillating at the frequency of the mass. And these axions could convert into photons, essentially, because the QCD axion in essentially every model will inherit a coupling, not only to GG joule, but also something, a coupling to F joule. And when you put in the electromagnetic fields into F, you see that this is actually a coupling to E dot B, the electric field dotted onto the magnetic field. So if you have a background E or B field, then that looks like a mass mixing term between the photon and the axion. So the axion can actually convert in a background electromagnetic field. It can convert into a photon. And this experiment here essentially looks for an oscillating neutron electric dipole moment. Or there's actually not just this, but there's a bunch of experiments that have sort of been proposed recently that look for those effects. And what Masha will talk about later today is black holes, so I don't need to talk about it. So that's the sort of a very fast overview of axion phenomenology. So we did the theory, really. And there's going to be a lot of lectures next week on sort of dark sector phenomenology, so it's not really my remit to cover it. But just to give you a taste of how we might search for this QCD axion. Yep.
Sorry, in the figure, the blue is constraint. So what are the colors?
Ah, okay. So everything that's shaded in is constrained or could be constrained by these experiments. So here, the blue is indeed constrained by these observations.
Okay.
It's not really a sharp cutoff, but this is a log plot, so it essentially is.
So what's the color for?
Blue is constrained. I think pink is for hints, right? So they're always on the edge of constraints. You know, Casper isn't running yet, so this is what I'm assuming green is.
Projection.
Yep. Yeah.
Projection.
So we should look at a projection over that axis, to understand which region is allowed.
Right. So yeah, pick an F.
Yeah.
If it's anywhere between here and here. it's not allowed.
Yeah.
Above it is fair game. But also these limits depend on what the precisely on what the photon coupling is as well.
Okay. So what does gray means? Gray color?
I think that is also excluded, but not by stellar.
Ground based.
Yeah.
But how about what is the telescope bulb? EBL.
Don't know.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yep. Okie doke. So that's a figure, sort of showing the current landscape of axion detection. But now I want to talk about, for about 45 minutes or so, about an idea. So how do I put this up? Does anyone know? Left, you know? Ah. Wow. Thank you very much. So now I want to talk about a sort of theoretical proposal using the axion. This proposal is a sort of, is the idea is to address the weak scale hierarchy problem using a field like the axion. And I'm going to discuss it. This is, again, absolutely not textbook. It's not even, you know, there's not even consensus on in the community on the sort of status of this proposal. However, I want to discuss it because number one, it's sort of quasi-cutting edge. It's only a couple of years old. And number two, it uses all the tools that we have discussed in the lectures. And number three, it sort of demonstrates that a radically different approach to the hierarchy problem, the hierarchy problem concerning the Higgs mass. And that was why people got excited about it in the first place. You know, it's not the details, as you will see, there are various problems in places or reasons to be concerned. But the overall picture, the idea was very new and very, very creative. And this is what got people excited about it. So I want to talk about that for about 45 minutes, and then you can choose between supersymmetry or extra dimensions. So this what I will talk about now is known as the relaxion. And the relaxion proposal was put forward by Peter Graham, David Kaplan and Surjit Rajendran in 2015. As I said, it's not a complete story, so depending on how many on where your level of robustness and how much of the picture you need to have before you say something works or doesn't work. This may satisfy you or may not satisfy you. As I said, different people in the community have different opinions about it. But the idea was that it's a new approach to the hierarchy problem, which it absolutely is. And the idea, the main point of this idea, which was sort of very new in the way that they managed to implement it, is that the point where the Higgs mass is much, much below the cutoff, as we saw in the standard model, that's not a point where there's a special symmetry. There's no symmetry that can make the Higgs mass small. So in the standard model alone, it's not a point of enhanced symmetry. However, what they emphasize is that although it's not a point of enhanced symmetry, so there's no sort of spurion type analysis you can do to explain why it's small because of the Top-Yukawa coupling and so on, it may be a point that is special with regard to dynamics. So imagine the Higgs mass is evolving in the early universe in some way, so it's changing because some fields may be changing their values. Then the point where the Higgs mass goes through zero might actually be a special point dynamically, because there could be dynamical processes that only occur when the Higgs mass is small, or dynamical processes that only become important when the Higgs mass becomes small. So this is sort of the idea of relaxing parameters has been discussed in many contexts, and essentially this one part of this story, but by no means all of it, but one part of this story, one of the ingredients, was already proposed a long time ago in the 80s by Larry Abbott to try and relax the cosmological constant, so to try and address that problem. So the idea of relaxing parameters and using dynamics is not totally new, but this way of doing it for the electric weak hierarchy problem absolutely was. So the idea is you take the you treat the standard model as an effective theory, just as we've been doing all along. So you write down all of the operators of the standard model, including the Higgs mass, and we're going to call it m squared. And as I said, there's no reason, so this would be something like lambda top squared, big lambda squared. As I said, there's no reason why this should be small. So if the cutoff of the theory, the mass cutoff, so like a coupling times lambda, is this big parameter, this large scale m, where m may be, you know, 10 to the 10 GV or something like this, then we have no reason to expect that the value of the Higgs mass would be far below that. So we know and appreciate that already. So you have the standard model, and then the next thing you do is you add a scalar, a massless scalar. Which has a shift symmetry, so it could arise in all sorts of places. We'll call this scalar phi, so it has a kinetic term. And interactions, all sorts of interactions that could respect the shift symmetry. If those interactions are higher dimension, then they should be suppressed by powers of this cutoff, which is related to this cutoff by a coupling. So those are the first two ingredients. We have the standard model, and we take it seriously as an EFT, and we add a massless scalar with a shift symmetry. The next thing is that we add an anomalous coupling for this scalar to gluons. So this is just what we studied in the last lecture. This is an axiom-like sort of coupling. So this axiom-like coupling, as we saw, this is a total derivative. So we can take that dj and using integration by parts, move it onto this guy, and we see that this actually respects the shift symmetry of the axiom-like particle. So this perturbatively will never generate a mass or any sort of potential that doesn't have any potential for the relaxion. I refer to phi as the relaxion from now on. However, we saw in the last lecture that it will non-perturbatively give a potential, which is just the usual QCD axiom potential.
Sure, what's the Lagrangian? You say you add an interaction, is that L interaction phi?
So this is d mu phi, interactions that respect the shift symmetry.
Oh, respect the shift symmetry. Yeah.
Right. So we're being we are taking the rules of EFT verbatim. We're not doing no tricks. We're just following the standard rules. And the next thing is that we add a small spurion that breaks the shift symmetry. Can you read this, by the way? Should I move towards? So then we're obliged, if there's now a parameter, I'm going to assume it's dimensionful. You can take it to be a dimensionless parameter multiplying the cutoff if you wish. You add a parameter that breaks the shift symmetry, so now we're obliged to write down all sorts of any operator that you could imagine that breaks the shift symmetry on phi, but it comes accompanied by a factor of g, so that in the limit that g goes to zero, you restore the shift symmetry. So just exactly the same spurion sort of thing I was talking about before. So we are obliged to write everything down, and we do it. So something like, I'm putting a minus sign just for ease. Phi h squared. There's nothing to stop now a trilinear coupling between phi and h. And once I've got this spurion that breaks the shift symmetry, there's nothing to stop me having a linear term for the relaxion. So everywhere I have the relaxion without the shift symmetry, I have to have a g. And following the rules of EFT, I absorb all the other dimensions just into the cutoff. And something like a mass term. So I got g squared phi squared. And all the way up, everything you could have. So these are the basic ingredients of the relaxion. And while the relaxion is a story about dynamics, it's actually really a story about symmetries. So it's symmetries in the background that lets you control the dynamics. Now, let's think about the shape of this potential at zero temperature. So at zero temperature, there's no scalar potential from derivative interactions. If I change the value, if I move along, say this is the relaxion potential, and if I had only derivative interactions, as a function of phi, if I change the value of phi by a constant, then this doesn't change at all because it respects the shift symmetry. So there's no scalar potential. But in the presence of these terms, there is a scalar potential, and you can see, for instance, as I change phi, this is a linear term, so the potential energy will go like this. There's a mass squared, so maybe it sort of turns up over here or something like this, but the generic form is that there's some smooth potential like that. However, as I go along in phi, there's a point at which the value of the total Higgs mass, which is m squared minus g phi, there's some value of phi, which is m squared over g, where the total Higgs mass passes through zero. So say I started with, let me do this way, actually. Say I started with, a large positive Higgs mass squared. Then there's a point, let's call it phi critical or something like this. Which is m squared over g. The Higgs mass squared passes through zero, and that means that if I keep pushing in that direction with phi, the Higgs mass, this term is now beating this term, so the total Higgs mass squared becomes negative. So I'm just plotting in the phi direction, but really this is a two-dimensional scalar potential. And I keep pushing in that direction, the Higgs mass squared has become negative, so a vacuum expectation value for the Higgs turns on. But we know exactly what this term does here. This term, the potential from the axion-like coupling, as we calculated it earlier, GG joule, will give us something like, I'll put the gauge coupling in, will give us something like m quark, the VEV of the quarks, plus Hermitian conjugate. And we know that m quark depends on the Higgs VEV. It's just the whatever quarks Yukawa coupling times V. Yep.
Doesn't one of those terms have the wrong sign?
Oh, definitely, for sure. But I'm not, I mean, yeah. Which one?
Probably the second one. G5 mod of H squared.
This guy here? Yeah.
The one to the left of it.
This one?
Yeah.
Yes, thanks. Yeah. Yep. But also this one, right? This should be minus, or was it minus?
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Details.
Yeah, because it's minus V. Yeah.
But none of this story matters. Anyway, so.
Is that G still the same G? It's a different G.
Ah, no, sorry. This is called alpha. Alpha QCD. Let's do that. Over 8 pi. Sorry about that. Okay, so we know that this gives, after we rotate this field into the quark part of the action, and then the quarks condense and you get this. This guy becomes, you get this potential here, which gave us the cosine, m quark VEV of the quark condensate was just f pi squared m pi squared. That's what we derived when we derived the axion mass. But we see that axion mass, and hence the pion mass, depends linearly, or depends on the Higgs VEV here. So what that tells you is that we have some scalar potential from this guy, who looks like, minus f pi squared m pi squared cosine of a over f. But m pi, in the limit that the Higgs VEV goes to zero, vanishes, because in that limit there's no explicit breaking of the SU2 axial symmetry. So when the quarks condense, you get an exact Goldstone boson. So this guy here cares essentially linearly, but he depends on the Higgs VEV. So now we know, but here you see we're moving along in the axion potential. Up here, the Higgs mass squared was positive, so to a good approximation, there's no Higgs VEV. You pass through this point here, and the Higgs VEV is turned on, which means that this cosine potential is turned on. So actually, after you've passed through this point, what I drew was not correct. You start to get wiggles from the cosine potential on top of just this linear piece. So the idea then is the following. So this is, I've just plotted this. This is, you know, all at constant time. I'm just plotting the shape of the potential as a function of phi. But then the idea is, what if in the early universe, the value of the relaxion field was just took some initial condition, might be, you know, might have started up here, might have started along here. We don't know. We don't know what the initial conditions are. Well, then what happens? Well, we know if it started up here in the early universe, it will start to roll. Say it started here at early times, it will want to roll down its scalar potential because it will evolve towards the minimum of its scalar potential. So during inflation, this thing will roll and it'll keep rolling. Have you had any cosmology lectures yet? So it'll roll just in a similar way to the inflaton. It'll slow roll. Roll and roll and roll and roll and roll. The whole time it's changing the Higgs mass squared while it's doing so. And then at some point, it will cross this critical value where the Higgs starts to get a VEV. That's, you know, at this point here. And then shortly afterwards, if the gradient of this potential is large enough, if these wiggles are big enough, it will get stuck and stop in here in one of the first minima that it comes across. Yep.
Yeah, I think what you call A is actually 5.
Pardon?
What you call A is actually 5.
Right? Ah, sorry, yes. Sorry. Yeah. So this is really the core of the idea.
Sorry. The field is not bound to be stuck there forever, right? There's maybe something.
Right, exactly. So this is an important part of it. You know, it doesn't have to be stuck there. It could tunnel to lower minima. And you can calculate that tunneling rate. We will come to the actual parameters that you need, what value you need these guys to be. And you can calculate that and see how long it lives. But that is a sanity check. Any other questions? Okay, so this is the, essentially the core of the idea, but we can dig it further and really see, really explore this sort of structure of this model a little bit more closely. So if we wanted to be able to get stuck, we've got the scalar. Ah, yes. And so the idea is as well is that if it gets stuck in one of the first minima, then we can choose where it gets stuck because we can control the gradient of this guy, of this overall slope, by this spurion G. And we know that this spurion G can be as small as we like it to be because it breaks the symmetry. If it's the only parameter in the theory that breaks the symmetry, no perturbative corrections are going to give you other terms that break the shift symmetry of phi that are much bigger than G. So G can be, in principle, as small as we want it to be. So where does it get stuck? We know that now, to a good approximation, V of phi is something like minus Gm squared phi minus F pi squared m pi squared cosine of phi. And then we go back to high school and differentiate the potential to find the minimum. The minimum will be when this is equal to 0. So we have that gm squared minus gm squared plus f pi squared m pi squared over f has to be 0. So then we see that so then we essentially get the constraint that f pi, it will stop whenever f pi squared m pi squared was equal to g m squared f. It will stop whenever this, shortly after this condition is satisfied, because that's where a local minimum has opened up. If this were much, much smaller, say you're just over here, and this is smaller than this term, then you get no local minimum, even though you've got the wiggles, it doesn't actually overcome the gradient anywhere. But it will stop around about the first time this, shortly after this condition is satisfied. But m pi squared depends on the Higgs VEV. but I can choose G to be as small as I want. So I can choose the M, the value of M pi squared, and hence the value of the Higgs VEV, where it stops, to be as small as I want. So then I can choose this theory. I can choose G to be small such that it will have stopped just after it scanned the whole way through, scanned the Higgs mass right down from the cutoff, and I can get it to stop just after it's passed through the cutoff by an arbitrarily small amount. That's the idea. So is that clear to everyone? So that's the core of the Relaxion proposal, and it's technically natural because I'm controlling where the guy stops with this parameter g, but this parameter g breaks the symmetry, so it can be small.
So can you describe the process again? Sorry, I just didn't catch the last.
Yep. So it's rolling down the potential,
right,
and it stops whenever this condition is satisfied, or shortly after this is satisfied.
Yeah.
And we'll come to our, there are details in that, but we'll come to them. So it stops just shortly after this is satisfied. So this means, but m pi is evolving because the Higgs VEV is evolving. So if I choose g to be very small, then even if f and m squared are large, I can get it to stop whenever m pi is small.
Okay.
And m pi is determined by the Higgs VEV, so that means I'm getting it to stop whenever the Higgs VEV is small. So you've gone the whole way through the cutoff, and then you get it to stop arbitrarily close to the point where you pass through zero for the total Higgs mass squared. Yep.
Are you flanking then g?
No, because it can be, there's no large, it's a parameter that breaks the symmetry, breaks the shift symmetry. So it can be as small as you want it to be. It will get, it's like the electron Yukawa. The electron Yukawa breaks a chiral symmetry on the electrons. So there's a question about why it's so small, but it's not a fine tuning because there's no large quantum corrections to it. And it's a very good question. And it's the same story here. So if you don't like, and you're going to see this is ridiculously small once we get to the numbers. If you don't like small numbers, Dirac didn't like small numbers, or big numbers, then you have reason for consternation. So it is an enormous puzzle as to why G could be as small as it will need to be. But it is natural in the sense that if we start with this effective theory, there's no reason to expect there to be large corrections to the scalar potential of phi that are any larger than these g terms, because if it's the only parameter in the theory that breaks this shift symmetry, then as I take it to zero, a shift symmetry is restored. Yep.
What would make it stop at the first minimum? Like if the bumps are too small, not even tunneling, like classically?
Yep, absolutely. So if you did this in flat space, if you turned off gr, then absolutely. So let me just do this. So let me put in I will answer your question right away. That's not in my notes. Okay, so in an expanding universe, the metric looks like this. So say we're doing this. So this is the main answer to your question is you need to do this during a period of inflation. And the reason is the following. So the metric looks like, I'm going to make a mistake here, certainly at least with signs, so please keep an eye on. So the metric looks like this, where this is the scale factor. So let's put this then into the action for a massive scalar field. So we get, so G is 1. Okay, so root.
To be a minus
one. Pardon?
To be a minus
one. Oh, sorry, yes. So root of minus, so minus g, I get a cubed, so I get a to the 3 over 2 t. In the kinetic term, I get the inverse metric, so I will get an a to the. Sorry?
A squared, right?
Oh, yeah, sorry, so a cubed. No.
In the G's.
Yes.
In the metric.
Yes. Thank you. There's going to be many, many, many more times this happens. Okay, so then we've got a cubed of t. And then we have dt of phi. word. I'm going to forget. I'm going to assume that this is spatially homogeneous. So all of the spatial terms cancel out, and then you've got are zero, and then you've got minus m squared phi squared. Okay. So let's calculate the Euler-Lagrange equations, the equations of motion. D by dt of dl by d dt of phi minus dl by d phi is equal to zero. So let's do this. So we've got the half I don't care about, because it will just all pop out. Or no, it will even cancel, even better. So then you've got d by dt of a cubed of t dt of phi minus m squared a cubed of t phi is equal to zero. So then I can cancel out all of the a cubed, apart from one time a derivative will hit this guy. So I get d by dt, so let me just write it as dots, phi double dot plus 3 a dot over a phi dot equals m squared phi. So that's the equation of motion. But a, and during in an inflating universe, a, well, by definition, Hubble is a dot over a. And in an inflating universe, that's a constant. So we get that phi double dot plus 3 Hubble phi dot equals m squared phi. So if Hubble is much, much larger than if Hubble phi dot is much, much larger than this term, you can see that a solution to this guy is that phi is just constant. But you can solve, and I'm sure this will happen when you get cosmology, in your cosmology lectures. There's a regime in which this guy is small, and you can solve this equation of motion here. And you find that phi is equal to phi zero, some initial value, e to the minus, you can solve this guy, e to the minus h of ht. Is that right?
Yes, there is a minus the line above.
Minus here?
Yes.
I brought this guy over here.
Okay, no, because there is a minus dl in d phi and a minus in the line.
Ah, yes. Sorry, thank you. So here?
Yes.
Ah, yes, simple harmonic oscillator. Super, thank you. Must have a 3. Yeah. Okay. So this means that, and then once you add this potential, you slightly tip it, so it will keep rolling, but it's rolling slowly. So, and this is what we call Hubble damping, which is essentially that there's what would be like, you know, this looks like the equation of an oscillator with a damping term, and that's exactly what happens. So the Hubble damping itself, as you're rolling down, lets you roll slow in a controlled manner. If there were no Hubble damping, conservation of energy would mean that by the time you've gone from here to here, you've picked up this amount's worth of kinetic energy, so you're getting faster and faster. And to answer whoever's question it was, you just keep rolling. You would never actually stop. But it's the Hubble damping is absolutely crucial in this story. Okay. We can actually put in the parameter constraints and see what the numbers will come out to be in this theory. So the first one is that the field has to evolve a distance. Delta phi is at least bigger than m squared over g.
So can you explain again what was your... I missed that part. So yeah, I understand this rolling down thing, but then what were you explaining there?
So that was Hubble damping.
Yeah, it was Hubble. How do you relate to this?
So Hubble damping means you roll slowly.
Right.
It's like an oscillator with a large damping
so
term.
So you're just saying that it's rolling down slowly.
It's rolling down slowly.
Yeah.
So then you don't, if the friction is enough, and we'll discuss, but if the Hubble friction is enough, then you can get stuck in a local minimum. But if you had no friction, then you would just keep rolling, because conservation of energy would just say, if there's no friction at all, by the time you've come to here, you've picked up this amount's worth of kinetic energy. So
it's only classical field configuration, right? If it's quantum, it can tunnel to the next one.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but this is a question of whether or not you get stuck.
Right, okay.
What about the point in which you start throwing? Is this general for any point, or you have found an oscillator?
Ah, no, good question. So what are the initial conditions?
Yes, sir, yes.
Right, okay. The nice thing about slow roll, you know, the equation of motion we just solved there, is so you can pick, it can start anywhere, we don't know. So obviously if you started way down here, it's not going to work. But half of the potential is above this point. But, for example, does it have to start rolling slowly anyway so that you don't overshoot these guys? Even if you give it a big kick of kinetic energy of order the cutoff, m, at the start, or lambda in this case, it will actually, the Hubble friction is enough to very rapidly, within an e-folding, slow it down to the slow roll speed. So it's really insensitive to the initial conditions in that sense. Okay, so it has to at least roll far enough to scan the whole way, the Higgs mass all the way from the cutoff to at least passing through zero. So that's this constraint here. The value of the Hubble constant during the inflationary period where this occurs has to be at least larger than m squared over m Planck. So the reason for that is that the potential energy change from this guy rolling alone changes by a value of order m squared. You can see that if we put in delta phi as m squared over g squared, plug it in here or here, you see that the total potential energy is changing by at least, sorry, m to the fourth, value of about m to the fourth. Hubble is v over m Planck squared. Hubble squared is v over m Planck squared. So Hubble is root v over m Planck. So Hubble has to at least be m squared over m Planck. Otherwise, you're not being consistent. Also, you have to have that the Hubble, this is getting to the sort of QCD axion bit, the Hubble scale during inflation has to be less than lambda QCD. There are two ways of thinking about this. So you need this axion potential to turn on in order for the scalar to stop rolling. I'm going to give you two different equivalent stories. One is that Hubble, you may have heard of the Gibbons-Hawking temperature, the Hubble constant during inflation, in De Sitter space, sort of behaves like if you're in De Sitter space, it's like you're in a thermal bath. So there's a thing known as the Gibbons-Hawking temperature, which is that there's a temperature, an effective temperature in De Sitter space, which is sort of like, which is related to Hubble. So this is similar to like the effective temperature in Hawking radiation, except our horizon is just from De Sitter. So what this tells you then is if Hubble is high, then it's like there's an effective temperature that is very large. If that effective temperature were larger than the QCD scale, you wouldn't even be able to form the instantons because, as I said, the instanton effects were going like e to the minus 8 pi over alpha QCD evaluated at some scale. So the relevant scale would be the temperature. So if you're at high temperatures, well above the QCD strong coupling scale, then alpha is small because you're at high, essentially, all of your scattering is happening at high energies, which then means that these instantons would be very suppressed and you wouldn't actually create this potential in the first place. The second way of seeing it is that these instanton effects only become large whenever alpha is of order 1, which is telling you that physically these instanton field configurations have a characteristic size which is of order that lambda QCD. So if you're at very high Hubble values, that means you have your horizon is smaller, the horizon scale or the curvature scale is smaller than, say, smaller than the size of the instantons, so you can't even feel the effects of the instantons. They would be outside your horizon. So it's two different ways of seeing the same thing, which is you need Hubble to be less than lambda QCD for this potential to be effective and to stop you. Another condition is that comes to this question of classical versus quantum evolution. Which is the Hubble scale has to be less than this parameter combination here. It's 1 over 3, sorry. And why this is because of this effect of temperature during inflation, this field will tend to fluctuate in a quantum mechanical sense by values of order Hubble. So it's like, so if you're in a thermal bath, your fields are fluctuating of order the scale of the temperature. Here, it's of order the Hubble scale. So as it's rolling down, it's actually fluctuating about the place. You want, in a given time period, let's call it one Hubble time. So one over Hubble is a Hubble time. In one Hubble time, you want it to roll classically further than its quantum fluctuations. Otherwise, you can't predict anything. If in any given time period, it is fluctuated further up or down this potential than it would have rolled classically, then you're in a quantum regime and you can't make any predictions. You can't say, I ended up here, or I ended up here, or I ended up here. You don't know. So you need the rolling to be classical, and it's a very straightforward calculation. You just correspond, you compare how far it rolls in one Hubble time from the potential, so just that equation of motion I showed you, versus a fluctuation of about one Hubble in a Hubble time, and you get this constraint here. And the last thing is that you need the number of E foldings, so the period of inflation, to last long enough to be able to roll far enough for that to happen. So again, you compare how far it has to roll with how fast it's rolling from that equation of motion earlier. And you can calculate the number of E foldings you need to have, and it's something like H squared over G squared. And then the last constraint is that you have to have a local minimum in any case, so you have to satisfy this equation here. So when you put all of these constraints in, I'll just keep those there. When you put all of these constraints in, you arrive at the following set of constraints. You find that so you can combine them all together and see if you can satisfy all of these inequalities at once. It's a nice little exercise. And you find that the cutoff has to be less than lambda QCD to the 4. This is really f pi squared m pi squared. M Planck squared cubed, sorry, over f to the 1 over 6. The weird powers of 1 over 6 and things are coming from this guy here. Which then goes like 10 to the 7 GeV, if you put the numbers in, 10 to the 9 GeV over F to the 1 over 6. So you see that already you can't have an arbitrarily large cutoff. In this theory, you can only offer an approach to the hierarchy problem that will work for theories where the cutoff is below, say, something like 10 to the 7 GeV, or if you push F down a bit, you can maybe do a bit better. Also, you find that this parameter G, which I had a dimensionful parameter, G is of order 10 to the minus 26 GeV, which is an extremely small coupling in dimension. Yes?
Given these constraints, can this relaxion be the same thing as the inflaton, or is that?
Yes, this is something people investigated at a first glance. No, because it's too slow rolling. You would not get the right density perturbations and all sorts of things. The potential is too flat. And I'm gonna I'm gonna write down one more equation, and then the last one will give you an idea why. So this is an extremely small number in dimensionful units, so we could write a dimensionless coupling as G over the cutoff. And then you're talking about something like 10 to the minus 32 or something like that. So, as I said, it's technically natural for this thing to be small, but it's certainly a big question as to why this parameter G could be so incredibly small from some UV story. And you don't know what the UV story is. There are many different ways you could UV complete it. But that's a potential cause for concern. The field range that you have to explore is about 10 to the 40 GeV. which for people who work in inflation would ring many, many alarm bells. It's very hard to get models of inflation where the inflaton, which is a scalar field, rolls more than a few times the Planck scale. This has to roll 10 to the 40, so something like 10 to the 22 times the Planck scale. So this isn't just super Planckian, this is super duper Planckian field excursion, which corresponds to an extremely weak force, essentially. So this is cause for concern. Again, in effective field theory, there's absolutely no obstruction to something like this happening. But in you want some UV story that will tell you, that will provide these parameters and these parameter ranges for you. There are ideas about how to do this. There are models. So it's not impossible, but it's still a bit bizarre. And the last thing is that your number of E foldings will be larger than something like 10 to the 43. So that's the number of E foldings. That's the guy that goes in the exponent, right? So normally we're talking about 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or something like that. This is 10 to the 43. So you need an extremely long period of inflation while this thing is you know, creeping down the scalar potential and until it gets here. You need a very, very long period of inflation. So, yep.
Is this because it's rolling up too fast? Or why do we let that
make it? Rolling too slow.
It's rolling too slow.
Yeah, I see, but
yep.
Why don't we just start closer to where it stops so that we don't get that many inflows?
Because then we'd be fine-tuning. We'd be choosing our initial conditions so that it will happen quickly. I just realized when I did the equations of motion earlier, I had a mass term. It should have been phi double dot plus 3h phi dot. And then it's the linear term, gm squared phi. And then you solve this bit of the equation. So then you get phi dot something like phi is phi 0. This must be a minus e to the, oh no, e to the gm squared over h t. Right, that must be right.
No, that is, this is a linear equation, right? So you don't have x.
Yes, sorry, even better, yes, thank you. Yeah, equation. Sorry, yeah, so that's the slow roll. So we have phi of t. Yeah, I was getting confused because I was thinking about the damped oscillator, so I had the mass term, but yeah, phi of t.
Your note is gm squared over 3h and times t.
Yeah, right. Times t plus some initial condition. Sorry about that. Yeah, so this is why, so when h is very, very large, this is a small and it's just rolling constantly, rolling slowly.
It might be modified a little bit.
Yeah, I think it should be an exponential. Yeah, it has to be exponential. So what is in the note?
I think you just missed the phi in the note on the right hand side. Maybe I see the wrong one.
My head is right.
This is
exponential.
Yeah.
Exponentially growing.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. There's a phi. I think in the note you missed the phi. So.
Ah, okay. Yes. Yeah, sorry about that. Oh, so it is, yeah. So what I wrote down earlier was h, but it's minus gm squared over h. Sorry about that. So there are many puzzles here corresponding to all of these weird parameter ranges, parameter requirements. And there are other puzzles, even bigger puzzles, like what you do with the cosmological constant problem, because we don't know, apart from using anthropics, we don't know how to address the cosmological constant problem. But here, you don't know exactly which one of these guys you're going to drop into. And if you plug in the field difference across here, the change in potential energy is of order f pi squared m pi squared. So if I stopped in here, versus stopping in here, the potential energy difference is much, much larger than the value of the cosmological constant that we observe. So somehow, whatever solves the cosmological constant problem would have to know which one of these you landed in, but you don't know precisely which one you're going to land in. So there's a big problem there. There's also a question, if you have such a long period of inflation, you're really talking about eternal inflation. And if you have eternal inflation, you get everything that can possibly happen happens. So in an internal inflation, you could, for example, have gotten stuck here, and then inflation could have carried on for a long time, and you could have tunneled down to the other ones, tunneled to other places. So putting this in a larger cosmological constant, a larger cosmological context, there are many, many puzzles. But nonetheless, it's a very sort of creative and an interesting idea.
You use the zero temperature potential. Is that because during inflation, the universe is cold? The early universe, don't you have to usually take into account temperature effects?
Right, so this is during inflation.
Okay.
So during inflation, the effective temperature is Hubble.
Essentially. Okay. After inflation.
Right, so great. So when you reheat, absolutely, when you reheat to above the QCD scale, if you do that, this potential, you're exactly right, it goes away until you cool down again below the QCD scale. So these wiggles collapse and you would start rolling again. But it's a straightforward calculation to see how far you would roll in that time between reheating and cooling down to lambda QCD again. And it turns out you don't roll far enough to change the weak scale by much. But you may, after that process, end up in another minimum. So you don't necessarily end up in exactly the one you were in, but you haven't rolled far enough for it to roll to a point where the Higgs masses become large again.
So you're on your right-hand side, it should be dL over d phi, so it's gm squared, no phi.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it's just linear in t. So there's no phi in that gm squared.
The units
squared.
Don't work out,
yeah.
Right? Gm, g
exactly.
Is unitful, so g, phi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you need to pull the phi.
Yeah.
Sorry, yes.
Okay. So it does become,
yes,
so it is, so
yeah.
There's no exponential,
yeah.
Just something times t.
Thank you. Finally. Sorry about this. This one? Yeah. So the potential energy just from this sector alone, not necessarily, not including the inflaton sector, is changing by m to the 4. So as it's changing by m to the 4, that means that Hubble is changing by at least, just from the relaxion itself, changing by at least m squared over m Planck, because Hubble squared is v over m Planck squared. So at least Hubble is changing by that amount. So Hubble during the inflation period, is at least that amount. So it would be inconsistent to assume Hubble was below that whilst having this change in energy.
So where are you imposing? You have to impose that the barrier height of the cosine function has to be large enough, right?
Yeah, so that's this one here. So we differentiate the scalar potential.
So, but shouldn't that be a greater than or equal? Shouldn't that be an inequality?
Yeah, sure. So G has to be less than this. Yeah. Absolutely.
So your UV's theory should be coming off in the cutoff, is that right? And
yes.
You want to arrange it so that the spherium is so, okay.
So it's a puzzle, but you can do it. You know, the clockwork models can do it and things
right.
Like this. So it's not impossible, but it's certainly puzzling, right?
Right.
Can you fix the problem why you don't want it to be, you know, large field inflation-esque effective field theory problems? Even if you have to go.
Right. So you are still, in terms of inflation, you're still in control of the effective field theory because the total energy density, which is the parameter that you're interested in for effective field theory, is changing by much less than M Planck. So even though you've traversed, so this is the normal answer to super Planckian field excursions for inflation. Even though the field has traversed an enormous distance, the actual energy density has changed by a sub-Planckian amount the entire time. So the effective field theory should be valid, but while the effective field theory is valid, it is hard. So, you know, there are these clockwork models that can get you such large field excursions, but corresponding to such small g's. But maybe I don't really know what the status is if you try to get something like this from string theory or something like that, which is a question that you really have to ask if things, if anything's changing by more than the Planck scale. So it's sort of a puzzle, but there's no clear obstruction. If you were requiring that the energy density changed by more than m Planck, then you'd be in trouble with the from the EFT perspective.
So effectively, it's because of everything in the potential is weighed by factors of changes.
Exactly.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions?
In the initial condition on phi, like the way that it's drawn there, it's like phi wants to start near zero, or like it, is it just at a large negative value? Because my intuition would be that it should be at a, like it should start somewhere really high, right?
Right, but there's no distinction between positive or negative, right? It's just, it starts somewhere of order cutoff over g, kind of squared over g, and you don't know for sure. If it started over here, then it's not going to work because it'll just keep rolling that way. But if it started anywhere left of this, you're good to go. Okay, any other questions? Yep.
Can you make g space time dependent?
So make g a field? Yeah, so in a generic UV completion, most couplings will be the background expectation value of a field. But if you try to make it also evolve on the same time frame as this, you could probably play more games, but I don't think you'll solve any problems in the sense that you'll probably end up with a more complicated description of the same thing happening. But maybe there's something you could do there. Okay. So then we should move on. So there's a sort of an option. We have half an hour left. We could talk about supersymmetry or extra dimensions or anything else that relates to naturalness that you might be interested in. I've prepared some things on supersymmetry and extra dimensions if you wanted to discuss them, but what do you think? What would be the preference?
Extra dimensions.
Extra dimensions?
Yeah.
Okay.
Take a vote.
Take a vote. Okay.
But do extra dimensions.
Sorry. In the.
Okay, so hands up for extra dimensions. Everybody. I have to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. And supersymmetry? 7, 8, 9. Sorry, it's extra dimensions.
You also asked something about other stuff.
Yep.
Maybe briefly also composite X or?
Right, a question about what we did. You weren't here on the first day or the second day?
Yeah.
So we did composite Higgs. Also for Susie, there's a lot in the notes.
Okay.
And my notes refer you to even better notes. So. Okay. So lightning introduction to extra dimensions. By the way, Susie, so let me just talk a little bit about Susie. So Susie, it's sort of okay that we're not doing Susie, although Masha, who's going to give the next lecture, told me I should do Susie. So after lunch, I spent half an hour preparing some notes. But Susie is still one of the most attractive still the most attractive solution to the hierarchy problem. It doesn't do everything. It has the little hierarchy problem now because the LHC hasn't seen anything. But you should, not discard it just because the LHC hasn't seen it, because any of the other things I've talked about are at least as much hot water as supersymmetry, right? And it also does lots of other nice things for you, like it provides a dark matter candidate, can give you a motivation for, or an explanation for how electric symmetry breaking occurred, because it occurs radiatively. If you evolve down from high energies, all of the parameters like the mass squared, it passes through zero near the weak scale for particular choices of parameters. You get gauge coupling unification and so on. And it's also just a very beautiful structure and theory and supersymmetry, even though not as many people are working on it with regard to the hierarchy problem and weak scale physics. It's really a core element of many parts of formal quantum field theory. So it's super duper relevant and you shouldn't ignore it. On the other hand, because it's so well motivated and so interesting, there's an enormous amount of very high quality literature. You know, there are many great books. If you're interested in sort of the slightly formal aspects, then John Turning's book is very good. So I recommend them to you before I start extra dimensions. So don't just dismiss it out of hand. And my notes have you know, about 20 pages of information, or 15 pages or so of information on supersymmetry, the symmetry structure and so on. So don't ignore it, even though we're not covering it because it was voted out. Okay, so people have thought about extra dimensions for a long time. I'm sure you've heard about, you know, Kaluza-Klein theories and so on. So in some sense, asking the question about about whether or not extra dimensions could exist is something that's very old. However, it was, I guess, 20 years ago, just over 20 years ago, when it was realized that thinking about extra dimensions could give you a very different perspective on the hierarchy problem, in this case, the hierarchy between the Planck scale and the electroweak scale. And this was essentially, you know, ignited by a paper by Arkani Hamid and Dvalli and Demopoulos. And then the next really big idea was by Randall and Sundrum, and I'm going to talk about both of these models. But the basic idea is that maybe, perhaps, the fundamental Planck scale let's call it fundamental is actually near the weak scale. So maybe there is actually no hierarchy whatsoever between the true Planck scale and the weak scale. So you may say, well, actually, we've measured the Planck scale, and it's a long, long way from the weak scale. But if you have extra dimensions, it turns out that the 4D Planck scale does not necessarily need to be anywhere near the fundamental Planck scale of the underlying extra dimensional model. So if this is the case, if the true fundamental Planck scale is near the weak scale, then there's no hierarchy problem, because there's no hierarchy. That's the idea. So all of the things I've discussed so far have in some way been attempts to find theories or structures involving symmetries where the weak scale is protected from a large cutoff, from corrections from a large cutoff. So might be, we didn't discuss it, but supersymmetry, composite Higgs models, twin Higgs models, the relaxion. All of these models, you have the weak scale here and you have a large cutoff here, and you do your song and dance to try and find a way that they could be comfortably separated. This does the opposite. This says, well, what if the true cutoff of the theory where all hell breaks loose is actually just here, and there's absolutely no hierarchy, so that you're bringing the cutoff down to the weak scale? Then there's no hierarchy problem, because there's no hierarchy. So let's explore this in a bit more detail. So the basics are the following. So the first thing to think about is what, as citizens of 4D, we would observe if we were to encounter a 5D particle. And in particular, we'll think about particles that are massless in 5D. So we will the whole time really be nodding towards gravity. So the graviton in 4D is massless, and the graviton in a five-dimensional model will also be massless in 5D. So it will satisfy the usual equation that we know and love, which is, you know, p squared. So if it has some four vector.
Sorry.
Yep.
Okay, maybe you're going to write, but five dimension means like four that are spaced like in one time, like, or?
So it means R4, not R4, R4.
Okay.
Plus an extra one.
And?
Or an extra two.
With no specification on.
Like, what's the signature of the exploration machine?
Yeah, but
okay. Oh, is it time like or space like?
Yes.
Ah, space like, space like.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yep. There are many confusing things happen if you go time like. So I'll call this P 3. So we have one time coordinate and three spatial coordinates in 4D, and then we call this guy P extra. So this is the momentum, the four momentum. Let's call it P mu. Is this guy here. So the zeroth component, I'm just calling P, not P0 or something like that. Then if this particle is massless in 5D, it will satisfy the usual equation, P squared is M squared. So we have P squared minus P3 squared minus P extra squared. So this could be, I'm not necessarily doing five dimensions. If it was five dimensions, this just would just have one component. Six dimensions, it would have two, and so on. This has to be zero because it's massless in however many dimensions. And we can just rearrange this equation. So this is P squared, so it's the energy, minus the momentum in 4D, P3 squared, is equal to P extra dimensional momentum squared. But we know that if we just lived in 4D, a particle with mass m satisfies this equation. Okay, it's just Einstein's equation. So what this tells us, so we can just immediately see that if there's a massless particle in extra dimensions, and we are living in a four-dimensional slice of that extra dimension, and that particle, if it has momentum in the extra dimension, to us that just looks like mass. Okay. This is a very quick way of seeing that you can have Kaluza-Klein states. If this dimension is finite, then the momentum in the extra dimension will be quantized, just like particle in a box quantum mechanics. So what we will observe is a whole tar, a Kaluza-Klein tar of states that have ever increasing mass, and their mass will be quantized because the momentum in the extra dimension is quantized. Okay, so is that clear to everybody?
So we basically came from like the 5D space to the space-time to 4D space-time, and we see the mass. So what about the like a particle which is in, like which has a zero mass, and then we send it from 4D to 5D. It is massless in 4D, but we
right.
send it to 5D. What happens to that?
So it's massless in 4D, then it has no extra-dimensional momentum.
Okay.
So, for example, the graviton that LIGO saw, essentially, is if we live in a slice of an extra-dimensional setup, that guy has no extra-dimensional momentum. Well, it is. So one thing is I've assumed the extra dimensions are flat. Well, it's not hand-wavy. I mean, this is, if I have...
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you will see lots of things happen, but imagine if we're in, you know, flat extra dimensions, then a massless particle in those extra dimensions has to satisfy this equation. Yep.
Is this large extra dimensions? Are they compactified in some way?
Yes. So well, at the moment I haven't compactified them, but if they are compactified, this will be quantized.
Okay.
Because you only have quantized just. Particle in a box, quantum mechanics.
So in this sort of scenario, I would assume you have to explain why we don't see top quarks that have fifth dimensional momentum.
So that would be a heavy top quark.
Well, right. It would look like a top quark with various possible masses that you could see.
Exactly. Each momentum mode is a Kaluza-Klein, a heavier top quark.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you have to. Well, I guess, I mean, will you discuss this? Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so so what I'm getting at is we can get from this very quickly to what happens for the conversion between the extra-dimensional Planck scale and the 4D Planck scale. because we know that the graviton in our in 4D that is the true graviton that gives us gravity is massless. So that must mean then that it has no extra dimensional momentum. And if it has no extra dimensional momentum, the momentum operator in the extra dimension, let's call our extra dimension y, is just the derivative. So the wave function of this field has to vanish. Okay, so this is all still, I'm in flat extra dimensions here. So if it has no extra dimensional momentum, then it has no dependence on the extra dimension. So it's flat, its wave function in the extra dimension is just flat. So this means then that, I've missed a page. Okay. So now we can parameterize our metric. So if we want to keep in mind what's happening with the 4D graviton, which we always will want to, we can parameterize our metric as, so the metric would be G M N DX M DX N. So where these capital letters run over all of the dimensions from 4D up to the extra dimensions. But if we're just interested in the graviton that doesn't have any dependence on the extra dimension, then we can write parameterize this metric as e to the, I'm just choosing a parameterization, some dependence on the extra dimension. So this is, I'll call this x, big X. Actually, that's a good way to do it. And then g4 mu nu, which is a function of just the 4D coordinates, little x, dx mu, dx nu, plus the sum over all of the extra dimensional coordinates. Yep?
Sorry, does this, so does the rest of the argument also hold if you take the mass of the graviton to be small and not zero?
In the 4D graviton?
Yeah.
Then
very small.
All hell breaks loose, right? The thing that's keeping it massless is the gauge symmetry of general relativity, which is diffeomorphism invariance. So you're sort of like gauging translations and boosts and so on.
Sure.
So if the 4D graviton is mass, it means you've broken diffeomorphism invariance. And then you run into a slew of problems. So you could do that, and you can actually play those sorts of games with extra dimensional models. But I don't want to do it now. Okay, so we can write our metric in this way. So there's a 4D metric that has dependence on the 4D coordinates and some overall scale factor that depends on the extra dimensional coordinates. And you can always, well, in most cases, you can choose a coordinate choice. That's what diffeomorphism invariance is. You can make a coordinate choice that brings the metric into this form. Okay, so now we can plug this into the Einstein-Hilbert action and see what our Planck scale is. So the kinetic term and interactions of the graviton come from the Einstein-Hilbert action. Which in extra dimensions, we will write like this. It's the integral over all of the extra dimensions. The extra dimensional Planck scale, which I'm going to call M big N. Call this G tilde. Okay, so that's the Einstein-Hilbert action. And it's E plus one. Einstein-Hilbert action in N dimensions. So N minus four is the number of extra dimensions. This is just the usual metric term, and this is the Ricci scalar. Okay, so we can plug this metric into here in this form, and with not very much work, you find then that your action looks like this. Where you recall that G4 only has dependence on the 4D spatial, the 4D coordinates that we know and love. So now all of the dependence on the extra coordinates has come in here. So we can integrate over the extra dimensions. I'm not going to be able to at the moment because I don't know what this function is. But we can integrate over the extra dimensions and compare this to the 4D Einstein-Hilbert term, which is integral of just d4x m Planck squared root of minus g4 r4 of g4. And we can see that then the 4D m Planck squared is related to this guy through the integral over the extra dimensions of this guy. So the 4D m Planck squared call it big X for the extra dimensions. Okay, so we now have a way of relating the 4D Planck constant that we observe, that we have to reproduce our 4D gravitational physics, to the fundamental Planck constant in the full n-dimensional scenario, and it's related to the geometry through the dependence on the metric. So if we have some non-trivial geometry in the extra dimension, this will pick it up, and it shows up in this integral here. Okay, so let's see what happens. So we could, for example, choose flat extra dimensions. So if we have flat extra dimensions, then the 4D m Planck squared is just mn to the n minus 2 times a product over the lengths, let's call it Rm, of all the extra dimensions. So it's essentially the volume. And then you can calculate if you wanted this to be near the TEV scale. So that's the whole idea, bring the cutoff down. So the 5D or n-dimensional Planck constant is near the TEV scale. This is up at 10 to the 18 GeV. So you can just solve for what this volume has to be. And the characteristic size of the volume, so if it's one extra dimension, it's just the length. If it's two extra dimensions, this would be the length of the box. If it were just if you were compactifying on a square, for example, turns out to be of order 2 times, so I've done it for a general number of extra dimensions, n minus 4 minus 19 over 5 to the 2n minus 4. So these are just numerical factors you shouldn't worry about too much. Meters. So let's pick n equals 5. So if we picked n equals 5, you can plug it in here and see how large the extra dimension has to be, for example, if the fundamental Planck scale was a TEV. And it turns out that the sort of scale you're talking about for this extra dimension is something like 5 astronomical units. So about the distance to Jupiter. Of course, we've not observed. If it were the distance to Jupiter, then the effective theory that we would live in for questions regarding gravity, even on the distance scale of the Earth, would actually be a 5-dimensional general relativity. So that is completely ruled out. But if you plug in n equals 6, so you have 2 extra dimensions, then this quickly goes down to a millimeter or so. And we haven't probed general relativity on scales. We're just starting to probe, or have recently probed general relativity on scales below a millimeter or around a millimeter, so you can get away with it. So this is an approach to the hierarchy problem where you take the cutoff, the full gravitational cutoff, which is the 5D or 6D or 7D m Planck, is near the weak scale, and then you don't have so much of a hierarchy. For a number of reasons, it doesn't quite work out as well as you would hope. One is that you would get a lot of resonances, all these Kaluza-Klein resonances corresponding to the extra-dimensional momentum modes of the known 4D particles, like the top quark and so on, and we would have seen them. So There are many, many of them. They're very closely spaced together. If you think that the energy scale of a millimeter is very low, but the mass splitting of these guys will go like something like one over the radius. Again, just particle in a box quantum mechanics. So there are many, many of these resonances, and they're very closely spaced. They're very weakly coupled to us, it turns out, but nonetheless, you can search for them, so they're very strong collider limits already on such a scenario. And another problem with flat extra dimensions is that actually these volumes are enormous compared to the fundamental scale. And this raises its own problem, because you have essentially a new hierarchy problem. So you don't have a hierarchy problem now about why the weak scale is near the fundamental Planck scale, because you can get them, you know, say you can't tolerate a TeV anymore, but if you could tolerate a TeV, that would have been sort of tolerable. But now you have an enormous volume, and that enormous volume corresponds to a very small energy scale. So there's a new hierarchy problem that comes up in the place of the electroweak hierarchy problem, which is how you can get these extra dimensions to be so large. So in some sense, the extra dimensional approach works, but it shuffles the hierarchy problem into somewhere else. There are ways of doing that. There are ways of naturally getting these very large extra dimensions. So it's not sort of, you know, it doesn't rule it out or something, but it's an extra issue. But there's another class of models known as Randall-Sundrum models, because it was Lisa Randall and Raman Sundrum who proposed them, which is very, very compelling. These models are very, very compelling because they're super duper simple and they don't have this large volume problem. So the idea is that you allow for extra dimensions, but now you allow for a cosmological constant in the extra dimension. You don't do anything peculiar, you just follow the rules of EFT and let that cosmological constant be in the same ballpark as the extra dimensional Planck scale. And when you do this, you get a metric that behaves more like this. Something like, I can't remember the exact numbers, but something like KY, where Y is the extra dimensional coordinate, and you have minus dt squared plus, you know, dx mu squared plus dy squared. And when you plug this, maybe it's with a minus, I can't remember. When you plug this in here, you get a 4D Planck constant, which is exponentially smaller than a 4D Planck constant, which is exponentially larger than the 5D Planck's constant. So this is known as a warped extra dimension. And there are many, you know, an enormous number of very interesting things about it. For example, now the volume, as I said, the volume doesn't have to be particularly large. It can be of order the fundamental Planck scale. So there's no hierarchy problem there. And furthermore, these models actually, through the ideas of ADS-CFT, which I'm sure you've heard about, because this is ADS space, our sort of dual can be another way of describing composite Higgs models, where we started in the first place, where you have some large range of energies, where you just have, for example, a gauge theory with quarks, and then eventually there's dimensional transmutation. The quarks become strongly confined, and you spit out a pion that looks like the Higgs. There are many, many connections between this extra dimensional scenario and that.
So why here is a space time-like?
Pardon?
In this new model, why is time-like coordinate to be ADS?
There's only one time-like.
Yeah. That's the time.
Then there is not ADS. I mean, ADS, there are two time-like coordinates, right?
And that's a specific embedding.
So...
Like, you can embed ADS in a coordinate system that has two time-like dimensions?
Yeah, I'm not... So you can choose... if you solve Einstein's equations, you get that, you know, GMN in... If you have a cosmological constant, it's something like lambda to, I don't have it here, to some power, I don't know, it's just this. GMN. So when we do de Sitter for inflation, for example, you can solve this with ds squared is something like e to the minus dt squared plus e to the, I'll call it k t or something like that, dx squared. So that's de Sitter. And when you do ADS, if this has the opposite sign, you can solve Einstein's equations with something like e to the k, and then it'll be a spatial coordinate, I'll call it z or whatever you want, minus dt squared plus dx squared plus dz squared. But I always just have one time-like coordinate for de Sitter or ADS, unless I'm misunderstanding the question.
That's what Matt was saying, I think, that you can embed. So ADS you embed, because it's got negative signature and you embed it in a one higher negative dimension.
Oh, sure. Space. Yes, sure. So you can look at it as the sphere or something
like this
and in a higher dimensional. Yes,
and that
absolutely.
Higher dimension that you embed in has two negative.
Right. But in the ADS space that you're in, there's still just one time coordinate. Sure. Sorry. Okay. And Randall-Sundrum also has Kaluza-Klein modes. Now, the spectrum, this is all in the notes, the spectrum is different from a flat extra dimension. We can search for those Kaluza-Klein modes, and we haven't found them at the LHC, which pushes this MN higher and higher. It needs to be now something like 5 TV or that sort of ballpark, which then tells you that even if this were behind the big hierarchy, you know, maybe this something like this is happening, then there's still a little hierarchy problem between, you know, a few TV in the weak scale, which we can't get around. And this is exactly the same sort of problem that afflicts all of the models that I've really discussed. Apart from the Relaxion, and it has its own separate issues, but supersymmetry, composite Higgs models, twin Higgs, and so on. Well, twin Higgs is a way of approaching the little hierarchy problem itself, but they all never quite do the entire job for you, which is sort of why we're sort of at an interesting time. The LHC is definitely telling us that with regard to the hierarchy problem, there's something very, very fishy going on, and we don't know what it is. We can build new models or try and understand why the models weren't quite working or may only partially work. Or maybe it's telling us that we're even posing the question in the wrong way, and we don't really know at the minute. But I think I'm running out of time, so I should finish here.